This podcast network, we are the podcast that take two seemingly unconnected films and slam them together like a vaudevillain and a staircase. I'm Andy Williams.
And I'm Sean Wilson.
And this week we're going to be talking to you about the highest rated films on the IMDb 250 that we haven't seen. So what we've both done is looked at the IMDb 250 and basically selected the films that we haven't seen yet. My highest one is rated at number 3, so apparently the third greatest film of all time, which is, you know, probably somewhat embarrassing. It's literally like the guilty admission that I gave to you not long after we first met was that, oh yeah, I haven't actually seen Godfather 2. And I remember you looking at me with disgust and disdain.
I mean, I looked at you with disgust and disdain because when you said you're going to make a guilty admission, I thought, oh no, what are you going to tell me? And then it was The Godfather. And I was like, oh no, it's even worse than I imagined.
Mm-hmm. So yeah.
I was really disappointed. So,
but that was too late. I mean, you know, you hadn't seen a Chaplin film. So let's just say that. So
my firing film back was, on all cylinders.
My film was number 3, which is Godfather Part 2. And your film is, Sean?
City Lights by the aforementioned Charlie Chaplin. So, which I believe comes in at number 40 on mm-hmm. on that list. So considerably lower down. And I will say that the lower down the list, that infers the more movies one has seen. But of course, that won't wash. That's not going to wash.
No, that will not wash. Yep. And you know that won't wash because although I had not seen the third film, the next film I hadn't seen was number 47. So it was just that The Godfather 2 was this gap. And it was frankly probably stubbornness on my part, which, you know, I had the DVDs, I had the trilogy because that's all you could buy. And I've seen the first one. I love the first one. I just never really had the appetite to go ahead and watch Godfather 2. It's almost like Godfather is the main course and I don't necessarily need the dessert to come with it.
It says so much about you and me. I mean, as soon as I go into a restaurant, I literally eyeball the sweet menu before I've even looked at the mains. And to stretch this analogy or to expand on it, what it basically means is I would never watch The Godfather on its own without at least considering watching The Godfather Part 2. But then that's just me.
And then that leads you to Godfather 3. So,
yeah,
lucky you.
That's just the sorbet at the end, albeit with a slightly sour flavour, a slightly unfulfilled flavour.
That's like saying you wouldn't watch Raiders of the Lost Ark without committing to watch Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
I mean, yeah, I mean, that's not a very nice meal, I'm going to be honest. Well, that's a meal that's going very, very well and then trips itself up badly. Really, really badly at the very end and spoils the whole experience. You know, that's basically what they're stretching this analogy ridiculously far now.
So that's the waiter pouring red wine over you.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So with your film being City Lights, the 1931 Charlie Chaplin film, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so this was an interesting transitional movie for Charlie Chaplin, made 4 years into the talkies era, as in the period when Hollywood transitioned from the previously dominant silent cinema into talking pictures. City Lights, despite having synchronized score and synchronized sound effects, does not contain synchronized dialogue, which had come in several years earlier with the jazz singer back in 1927. Mm-hmm. Chaplin was not interested in that. He wasn't interested in courting those trends. He had, of course, made his fame with early silent pictures. This was the arena from which the classic character, the Tramp, had emerged. Mm-hmm. And he stuck to his guns and said, no, synchronized music and sound effects in City Lights, but no dialogue whatsoever. And it's interesting looking back at the development of the Tramp, because there, or the Little Tramp, as he's also referred to, because there are multiple contradictory accounts as to when and where this character emerged. I mean, a little bit of context about Chaplin himself. I mean, born in Kennington Cross in London, had a, you know, famously very, very difficult upbringing. His mother was in and out of various asylums, but he found his feet in vaudeville and music hall review in London, was taken in by the Carnot Company in the UK. They went and toured around the USA. He eventually fell into the Keystone Company under Max Sennett. And there are various differing accounts as to at what point the Tramp emerged. And Chaplin himself said that he first donned the costume for the film Mabel's Strange Predicament, although the first time we saw him was in the 1914 film Kids Auto Races. That was the first time he'd appeared, although Chaplin said that he'd actually first donned the costume in Mabel's Strange Predicament, but I know there are all sorts of contradictory accounts about this.
Yeah, there was at least four people that tried to lay claim to the creation of the tramp, and one of them was making sort of knockoff Charlie Chaplin films, and he went by the name of Charles Aplin.
You got to love how brazen that is.
I've really got to pick my words carefully here, haven't I? So Charlie Chaplin sued Mr. Aplin to say, look, you're ripping me off and this is too far. And the basic defense that that Mr. Aplin had was that he just went, well, you nicked it, so... You know, and then a couple of other people from Charlie Chaplin's vaudeville days sort of came out and said, look, we kind of created this character before you. If you look at what we were doing on stage together, it's kind of what you're now famous for. And the thing is, there was a history of tramp-like characters, and they took inspirations from actual tramps that people were tramping around the US and stuff. So, you know, it's a touchy subject, I think. And whilst, you know, Chaplin was clearly the most successful and probably the most talented to try and do it, which was why he succeeded as well as he did. But yeah, I mean, you talk about, we talk quite often about three film runs, like great runs directors go on. And City Lights, Modern Times and The Great Dictator is got to be up there as one of the greatest three film runs of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it is interesting that Chaplin did eventually fall under the auspices of the Talking Pictures. You know, he eventually found his way into that with The Great Dictator, which has got one of the great monologues delivered to camera at the end of it. But I think that City Lights was one of the last bastions of a dying breed of Hollywood cinema, because Talking Pictures had completely turned the whole notion of filmmaking inside out, because prior to the release of The Jazz Singer, there were the notion of synchronized music and effects was itself revolutionary prior to The Jazz Singer, but that movie just happened to take it one step further by featuring synchronized dialogue, as said by Al Jolson. I found a fantastic interview by one of the technicians at the time called George Groves, who'd worked with this system that was later co-opted by Warner Brothers called the Vitaphone system, which helped amalgamate music, sound effects and dialogue all together. And it blew the doors off Hollywood. It marked the end of one era and the beginning of another era. But Chaplin wasn't about to give in to this. He stuck to his guns. He followed his instincts. And City Lights turned out to be a huge box office success. He seemed to be flying in the face of popular trends, but it didn't matter. It worked. And the story is essentially the story of the tramp, or the little tramp, credited as both, who falls in love with a blind flower seller played by Virginia Cherryl. And at the same time, he also saves an inebriate millionaire played by Harry Myers from committing suicide. And this then unfolds as an allegory or a fable, however you want to see it, in which the tramp learns about how it is best not to give in to material wealth and material gains, how it is best to not give in to avariciousness and selfishness, and how to respond with compassion and dignity and humility. And he learns this through his interactions with these various characters, with the blind flower seller and with the millionaire. So when he's taken under the wing of this very, very rich alcoholic who only seems to recognize him when he's drunk, when he sobers up, he's got no idea who this strange bow-legged, bowler-hatted, mustachioed figure is in his house. There are clearly sort of very, very damning things being said about, you know, about capitalist wealth and exploitation. And yet at the same time, the tramp finds himself smitten by this very, very unassuming girl who is afflicted with this disability she can't see. And yet he forms this sort of deep-seated emotional connection with her. And it's a really quite powerfully emotive and, I have to say, very, very, very funny story that plays out. And the flower girl comes down with a fever, and the tramp is kind of battling with his impulses as to whether to fall in with his newfound millionaire friend or whether to raise money for her health. In the end, he chooses the latter, and he embarks on like various schemes to help raise money to nurse her back to health and to also to raise the funds so that she can be cured of her blindness, which is ultimately what he works to at the end of the film. He embarks on like various harebrained schemes. At one point, he agrees to take the fall in a boxing bout, you know, and the initial idea is that he and the fighter who he's against will split the difference 50-50. But then the original fighter ends up having to run away from the police and he's substituted by somebody else, which means that the tramp actually ends up being knocked out for real. Because he said to the initial guy, look, please don't hurt me. We are going to split it 50-50. But then that guy ends up being swapped by somebody else who really does punch the tramp's lights out. So there are wonderful set pieces in it. I mean, there are just little incidental details which plays into the notion of the music and the sound effects. I mean, there's a moment where the tramp is slurping spaghetti, which is accentuated by the sound of a slide whistle, which is just hysterically funny. You wouldn't think that someone eats slurping spaghetti would be funny, but it's the combination of the physical performance and the musical sound effects that works.
That's what Chaplin did. That's what Chaplin managed to do, was that he did take after take after take after take because it was so hard to get this stuff right.
And he was a taskmaster. He was a real taskmaster.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for City Lights, right, he shot somewhere in the region of 314,000 feet of film. So bearing in mind, we're talking of the days where he actually had proper film. 314,000 feet. Now, the completed film runs at just over 8,000 feet. So, I mean, that makes a shooting ratio of about 38 feet of film for each foot of film that was actually in the film. So, I mean, 38 times longer was the amount. And, you know, one of the scenes that they really, really struggled with on the production was when he first meets the blind flower girl. You know, he had several different versions, one where he was just kind of walking past her. And, you know, this is the meet cute, right? In every rom-com, you get a meet cute. And he just couldn't quite understand what they needed to have in order to get them to meet and coexist and finally have that moment between them. So they shot all sorts of different things. He actually fired Virginia Chera from the film at that point and tried it with another actress and then another actress. They did this for hundreds of days. And then he sort of, the light bulb went off and he realized that, no, it actually does need to be Virginia Chera. And what it also needs to be is a car door slamming. So they tried it out, which is ironic, I guess, considering he'd fought sound pictures so much that it was the sound that he needed to create this moment between these characters. And what he did was, he had someone coming out of the car and slamming the door just as the tramp was walking past. And then they tried all sorts of different ways. But then, you know, he settled on the bit in the final film where he's trying to sort of cross the road and he ends up walking through the car. And that's the moment that they get, that he gets the attention of this blind flower girl. And I think that what the film manages to do is show you their relationship in such a good way, in that you really kind of care for them. It's kind of the first rom-com in that sense, as far as I can tell. And what Chaplin always managed to do was put his tramp character in really, really almost fantastical situations, but they're always kind of done by circumstance or by coincidence. He's never vicious, he's never vindictive, but he just happens to be a victim of circumstance, like you said, in the boxing ring. And I just think that's kind of the genius of it, and why we as an audience are kind of always on the tramp side, is because, you know, there's scenes in all sorts of Chaplin films. There's one in Modern Times, which is quite famous, that he's walking down the street, he picks up a flag and starts waving it to give it back to the person that dropped it, and then he ends up at the front of this socialist march, which ends up getting him arrested. Like, yeah. It's just complete coincidence, but because of that, it then spirals out of control. And I think that's what Chaplin was a genius at doing, was putting the audience completely on the side of the tramp.
The tramp was a fascinating character because he's not in lockstep with his surroundings in any of the films in which he appears. And Chaplin himself described the character as a contradiction. He said he wanted the pants baggy, the coat tight, the hat small, and the shoes large. And then he added the mustache. And then I quote him, "The moment I was dressed, the clothes and the makeup made me feel the person he was. I began to know him, and by the time I walked on stage, he was fully born." And the idea being that, you know, this character in the context of City Lights, you know, you wouldn't envisage him falling in love with this girl. And indeed, at the end, when she has been cured of her blindness, the situation is kind of refracted kind of back on him a little bit. He is the character who's kind of ostracized and destabilized because his clothes are baggy. And then he walks past her at the end, and then she kind of implicitly recognizes him, despite the fact that she's never seen his face because her blindness has only recently been cured. She implicitly recognizes who he is from the touch of his hands. And the idea being all the way through the movie, there's one bit earlier on where he trips someone up in order to retrieve half a cigar off the floor, and one man goes to get it. And the tramp sort of trips this guy up and steals the cigar because he's hankering for a cigar and he can't buy one himself. So he's going to steal the remnants of another one off the pavement, but he has to basically step over another person in order to get it. At the end of City Lights, the tramp is the one who has been destabilized. He is the one who is conscious and cognizant of his shabby, shambolic appearance. And yet the flower girl, upon recognizing him, responds with all the love and all the vitality and all the warmth that she can muster. So it's a very, very powerful allegory about humility and about the need to avoid avarice and the need to avoid judgment. This is very well masked within a film that's still very, very, very funny. The bit when he's at one of these sort of hedonistic millionaire parties and he ends up accidentally swallowing a whistle, which means that every time he hiccups or breathes, he emits like a sharp like chirrup, which means that at one point he accidentally hails a taxi and says, "No, I don't want it." And then he ends up doing it again, and then a load of dogs come and greet him. I mean, it's just sublime. It's so simple. The ideas are so simple, and what these ideas do is you're actually blindsided as to how powerful the message of the movie is until the very, very end, when the situation is turned back on the tramp and he realizes that, oh, maybe it's best not to look down your nose at other people. Maybe it's best not to aspire to material wealth and money at the expense of other people. The idea being that, you know, the money does not make the gentleman, which is, I think, the thing that he learns.
Well, the thing I find fascinating about it is how contradictory it is to Chaplin in his real life. Like, we, you know, we always talk about trying to separate the art from the artist, right? But Charlie Chaplin as a person, not the character, right? Charlie Chaplin, you mentioned earlier, he grew up poor, he went to the Lambeth Workhouse and all that sort of stuff. He had a really horrible childhood. And he was always trying to outrun poverty. He confided in his daughter sort of later in his life that he was scared of going back to being poor, and he never ever wanted to be poor. That's why sort of during his career, he always signed short contracts when he was contracted to a studio, and he was always renegotiating them up and up and up because he knew his true value. And then he made enough money to create his own studio and give him such relative independence with United Artists. So, you know, even we talk about City Lights being sort of the kind of the end of the silent film, but he went on to make Modern Times 5 years later, which he still made it as a silent film. You know, so we're then talking 9 years after the Jazz Singer, which is, do you know what I mean? It's crazy that he still went on and made a silent film. But the reason I bring this up is because he as a person seemed very, very concerned with material wealth. And throughout the course of his films, what he always managed to do was put the tramp in sort of competition with different classes. And especially, he'd never punch down, because he never would punch down. But what he managed to do was put the tramp at odds with those sort of higher levels of society. So the fact that the tramp learns the lesson he does within City Lights is very, very contradictory to the actual Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, well, that comes out in his autobiography, because in his autobiography you get the sense that Chaplin's acutely aware of his background. He's like painfully haunted and racked by that upbringing in Lambeth, and yet in the autobiography he professes not to be seduced by the glamorous lifestyles of the rich and famous in Hollywood. And yet when you read the autobiography, he very clearly is. I mean, the amount of name checking with famous people that he does, it's like, sorry Charlie, the game's up. You know, I mean, I don't believe when you say that you weren't seduced by that.
Just... Well, speaking of name-checking, the lead orchestrator on this film was one Alfred Newman, who was kind of considered one of the godfathers of the film score, along with Eric Korngold. So he, you know, worked on a couple of Chaplin films. They subsequently fell out on Modern Times because I think basically Newman got past the point of no return. He was like, you know what, I've had enough of this man trying to take over and do my job for me. But he was credited with being the lead orchestrator on City Lights. So, Sean, why don't you tell us a little bit about the score, which I sort of take into account the fact that it is a silent film, therefore mostly score.
Yeah, it is. And it's important to note that there are different modes of film music, and this falls into the illustrative mode of film music, which is that it's music that very, very overtly and deliberately and explicitly mirrors the action beats on screen. So when someone, you know, when someone falls over, you might get a bit of a tuba or a French horn or a trombone. When someone slurps spaghetti, you get the slide whistle. So it's what we would probably call in the modern age Mickey Mousing the action, which is, you know, that's part and parcel of silent cinema.
But that's kind of eating the snake, because Mickey Mouse was directly influenced by Charlie Chaplin.
It is. It's a weird cyclical thing. And thank you for calling me out on that. And I have no answer other than to completely agree with you and say it's a really, really good point. So, but that should not lead one to underestimate the precision with which the music is orchestrated. I mean, as you quite rightly said, Alfred Newman was one of the founding fathers of film music. Just after City Lights, he would go on to write the 20th Century Fox fanfare. And I write about this in my forthcoming book, The Sound of Cinema, which I'm not sure I mentioned.
I should have also mentioned and given him the kudos that he deserves. I mentioned Eric Korngold. I didn't mention Max Steiner, and I didn't mention Dmitri Tiomkin as well.
Okay. It would be a great moment of flattery on my part if you were reading something that I'd written, but I suspect...
No, but I have, and it's in my brain. So
I've imprinted on you. Yeah, there you go. This is fantastic.
So I'm sorry, I only listed one or two godfathers of American film scores, and they kind of needed to be at least four.
But to be fair, there are quite a few of them. And Alfred Newman was one of them. I mean, it's interesting with Chaplin. Chaplin was an auteur in every sense, including the music. He wasn't musically trained, but he had a very, very musically astute ear. He would literally verbalize the notes that he would want his composers to do. And he would literally go on a note by note. This is how fanatical he was. It must have been a nightmare to work with. But every single note that you hear in a movie like City Lights is there because Chaplin wanted it there. He didn't perform in the orchestra. He didn't conduct the orchestra, but it's his imprimatur on the music. And it was City Lights was co-composed with Arthur Johnston, while, as we said, Alfred Newman arranged it. And apparently there were 95 cues written for this film. Although apparently the sound quality wasn't great on its initial release, and a later 1989 re-release was rescored by Carl Davis, who wrote the World at War theme, the BBC World at War theme, which apparently brought the theme into greater clarity. But it's a really fabulous example of what was a dying art at the time this film came out. The idea that illustrative music is the inner monologue, the inner dialogue of the characters, however you want to voice it. You can't hear them speaking, but the music tells you what they're thinking and tells you what they're feeling. It's all there on the surface. That is the modus operandi of silent cinema. In the absence of the human voice, the music becomes the voice. But it's fascinating with Chaplin. He didn't play an instrument, but it's his score. And same with, I mean, I think this was the first big film on which he undertaken this, as I understand.
That was going to be my question. Am I right in thinking this was the first score that he'd done?
Mm. Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was the first time he'd really embarked on this, and he would subsequently do it. He would subsequently do it again. There's a fabulous story told by the composer David Raskin, who was drafted in to help on Chaplin's score with Modern Times. And Raskin, who was then a sort of fledgling up-and-coming composer, obviously by 1936, Chaplin was very, very established. Raskin dared to question Chaplin's love of English music hall review, which he was attempting to transpose into the modern time score. Raskin questioned that and said, "Are you really sure you want this in this score for this film?" Chaplin then fired him for being an insubordinate little twerp, but then promptly brought him back on board. He was persuaded to bring Raskin back aboard, and they had a fabulous working relationship after that. I think Chaplin admired him for daring to stand up to him. That's the impression I get. And the rest, as they say, is history.
So what's fascinating is that we're talking about a film here that was made in 1931. So, you know, it is literally history. It's film history that's managed to live on. We're talking about it now in 2022. So it's lived on past Charlie Chaplin's lifespan. And, you know, we're coming up to, what, 90 years? If any film can last that long, there's clearly something magical about it. And I think that what City Lights manages to do is take the relationships that he has with the millionaire character, as well as the blind flower girl, and really what Chaplin manages to do with them is give them real connections. And in amongst all of the sort of hilarity that he manages to put into it. And, you know, even to a modern audience, I think that this film works. And it's not just because of the comedy, because if anything, I think the comedy is kind of dated to the extent that everything we see in this film, we have seen elsewhere, because it was so influential, is literally influenced everything we've ever seen. You know, the what you think of as comedy and what you think of as funny, it still works because it's Chaplin doing it, but it's not unexpected in a way that it might have been to that audience. But I think it works on a different level for us because the characterization of these sort of three characters are so strong, and the relationships are so strong, and the message of the film is so strong.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful experience, and I think that the level of very tender insight into it, I think it shows Chaplin, for all his flaws, was a very humane filmmaker. I mean, you look at something like
possibly, you know, more so than he was an actual person.
I mean, you're opening a huge can of worms there. I mean, let's not go into that. I mean, you know, a lot of great artists are very flawed. Let's say that. Very, very, very flawed people. Would you agree? Is that a very diplomatic way of putting it?
I mean, it's a can of worms, like you said, that I should not have even gone near. Possibly, yes, there's a levels of appropriateness, and I think that Chaplin definitely crossed them and overstepped them through his obsession with perfection. And I think that what he did to his actors, in that he literally wanted them to parrot what he did, was possibly very insulting. And who he was as a person, some of the things he did outside of the film industry, which did directly result in he directly influenced and referenced in his later films. Yeah, I think that he was a very problematic person.
Well, on that note, to go back to the subject of the music, apparently the main melody from this movie, La Violetera, translated as Who'll Buy My Violets, was actually taken from a Spanish composer called Jose Padilla, and Chaplin chose not to credit him for his main melody on this film, and Chaplin was sued for it. Perhaps unsurprisingly, so clearly Chaplin must have thought with all of his influence, oh, I can get away with this. No one's heard of this melody or this composer. That was a serious mistake. So if that was his mode of thought.
Well, I mean, it was possibly more so that he wanted more and more credit for himself, because some of his detractors at the time actually said that the reason that he took over doing the music was because he wanted more credit, and he wanted it to be un film de Charlie Chaplin.
And it was un film de Charlie Chaplin, as indeed everything else. The fact that he took such control of the music just embodies who he was as a filmmaker. He had, you know, a fanatical level of control, but it's that level of control and prestige that continues to resonate all of these decades later. I think City Lights is a masterpiece. I think it's fantastic.
Completely agree with you. Absolutely agree with you. It is. And you know, we're kind of on home turf on this week. There's not going to be either film that either of us particularly dislike, purely because we have picked some of the greatest films of all time by definition. In 1949, the critic James Agee for Life magazine said that the final scene of City Lights was the greatest single piece of acting ever committed to celluloid. Stanley Kubrick rated City Lights as one of his top 10 films of all time. Andrei Tarkovsky placed City Lights as one of his top 10 films of all time. You know, Fellini loved it. It was, you can basically throw a rock at any filmmaker and they were influenced or loved City Lights. It's an absolute behemoth of a film. It's possibly Chaplin's best. It's pretty hard to dispute that. You know, you can look at Modern Times, you can look at The Great Dictator, you can look at The Kid, you can look at The Gold Rush, but I think you're hard pressed to come past any better than City Lights. So we're going to move on now to a very, very different film. Like we try to do on this podcast, is we take two seemingly unconnected films, and I think there's been very few films not as connected as The City Lights and The Godfather Part 2. So I've got the monumental task of trying to sum up the plot of The Godfather Part 2.
Oh, I lucked out with this one.
Yeah, kind of.
I really lucked out with this one.
Kind of. I mean, I can go for the full thing if you would like me to, or I can just describe it as... So The Godfather Part 2 is just an epic crime drama. It's the film on which all gangster films are now based, and The Godfather 1 and 2. And what this does is it picks up the thread from the first Godfather telling us about the Corleone family. So what we get with Godfather Part 2, why am I even summarizing it? Like, people haven't heard of it. But anyway, we'll get
there. I mean, to be honest, you could just summarize it by doing Al Pacino noises, couldn't you?
What?
Like, you could just do it like that. Just like, just, although he doesn't do that in this one, does he?
I'm not just... doing that. But what this does, it tells both, it's both a prequel and a sequel, which at the time was groundbreaking because there weren't that many sequels actually getting made. The word franchise didn't exist, especially to have, you know, something part two. Like, the studio were actually reluctant to have that. It was something that Francis Ford Coppola insisted upon. And he didn't want to come back and direct it. He wanted this sort of young up-and-coming director to direct it by the name of Martin Scorsese. Wonder whatever happened to him. But he, Coppola, you know, returned. He managed to get sort of all sorts of different things from the studio, such as the permission to write Great Gatsby sort of thing and to make the conversation before it. And, you know, he we're talking about great three-film runs, right? We've got Godfather Part 1, The Conversation of Godfather Part 2, and Apocalypse Now. You know, that's pretty hard to dispute those.
Yeah.
So I'm dodging the point. I'm getting around the point here of the actual plot. So we find out a little bit more about Vito Corleone, who in this version is played by Robert De Niro. At the start of the film, he's not called Vito Corleone. He is called Vito Andolini. And what he does is he suffers all sorts of issues when he's in the town of Corleone in Sicily, therefore manages to get over to America and try and fit in there. And that's where he ends up becoming the godfather that we know. So we get to see him throughout his young life in New York in the sort of 1910s, 1920s, and we sort of end up with him in 1941. Simultaneously, we're told the story of Michael, who is played by Al Pacino, who is kind of overseeing the family since Vito Corleone's death at the end of the first film, and he's kind of working it into the ground. It's not really as successful as he thought it would be, as it was under the heyday of Marlon Brando's Vito. So, you know, he's going off, he goes off on a business trip to Cuba. He's trying to appease a Jewish mob boss called Hyman Roth, whilst at the same time appeasing someone within his own family who's got beef with Roth. So they've got all these kind of different threads happening, kind of like with the first film, in that it's very, very slow and it's very, very deliberate. But I think what it manages to do is it kind of delivers on the promise of the first film, in so much as the first film tells us about this family and about how this family, what this family do and how they manage to exist, and the not really the great things, because it doesn't really look at them in what's good and what's bad, but how this family has managed to make its fortune. And what this does is it shows the flip side of that. It's the tragedy of it, and shows how absolute power can corrupt absolutely.
It's what it basically is. It, I mean, to call it a gangster movie, I think is a bit reductive. It's a story about the battle for the soul of modern America. That's effectively what it is. It just happens to be filtered through the prism of this one mobster family. It's a really, I think it's an absolute masterclass in terms of how to use parallel timelines that tease out various nuances in each other. So, for example, what you have with the young Vito storyline, obviously young Vito played in a star-making role by Robert De Niro, almost silent role by Robert De Niro. It's not a vocal performance at all, but it's an intensely physical one, and he approximates what we would imagine a young Marlon Brando to act like really, really well.
Well, De Niro studied the first film. He studied Brando. He made meticulous notes about, you know, the way Brando stroked his face with the backs of his fingers, the way that he held himself, the way that he moved his shoulders. And I think he lifted his forearms when he wanted something. Like, the level of detail that De Niro sort of picked apart the performance of Brando is astonishing. And, you know, you mentioned it's not really a dialogue heavy. Even when he does have dialogue, it's in Sicilian. He learned an entire language
Yeah.
Just to facilitate this performance. It's an absolutely phenomenal performance, like you say, especially when you consider relatively how little he's on screen.
Yeah, yeah, it is. He's not on screen for very much, but it's a really, really compelling story of how of the immigrant experience in early 20th century America. And this is foreshadowed by a brilliant image that happens sort of chronologically later in the movie, in which a Sicilian family are having an outdoor meal, and they casually pass around a statue, or a little model of the Statue of Liberty, as if indicating that America is theirs for the taking, which it was, you know, at this moment. This is how Sicilian crime families became established in America at the turn of the 20th century, La Cosa Nostra and things like that. And what the film does is it contrasts the destinies between young Vito and his eventual son, Michael, played by Al Pacino. The idea is that Vito, in spite of the bloodshed that he enacted, he's seeking to set up what he considers to be a legitimate business opportunity. He sees America as a land of opportunity, and he thinks, okay, it's mine for the taking. There are rich seams to be mined here. And that relative sense of optimism is contrasted with the absolute cruel, cold calculation of Michael, who is picking up the mantle in the wake of the older Vito's death many, many years later. And Michael has just absolutely calcified into this, you know, ruthless, utterly disloyal crime boss who suspects everything and everyone. And Michael has absolutely not absorbed the mantle of his father at all. And it compounds the sense of tragedy, because if you think back to the first Godfather movie, Michael didn't want any part of the family at all. He did not want to get involved. You know, he has the relationship with Kay, Diane Keaton's character, but with the execution on Don Vito, his father's life, Michael is then drawn into the fold, and he must become the substitute godfather. You fast forward that onto The Godfather Part 2. Michael has cemented his power, but in the process, he's pushed everyone away from him. And it's quite terrifying. Well, it's really well done.
Yeah, it's to the extent as well that it's a repeated motif throughout the film, is that Kay says to Michael that, you told me that we were going to be legitimate. You told me 8 years ago that we were going to be legitimate in 5 years, and here we are.
Mm.
You know, the relationship that he has with his wife is fascinating. And again, she's brilliantly played by Diane Keaton. And the scene where it all comes to a head, where she told him that she actually had an abortion rather than the miscarriage that she told him, because she didn't want to bear his child. It was heartbreaking. It was shocking. And it was exactly what it needed to be in the film. And it was really, really hard to watch. And it was the way that you could tell that Al Pacino's performance and Michael specifically was spiraling so far away from the sort of doe-eyed young soldier that returns to the family after being away at war. And the fact that they bookend the film as well with the scene where Sonny reappears, with James Caan's Sonny reappears, who interestingly commanded the exact same fee for The Godfather Part 2 that he got for The Godfather Part 1, despite being an absolute main character in The Godfather Part 1.
All I can say is, man knows how to negotiate.
Well, I'm not being funny. You can just turn around and say, I'll do it, but who's your second choice to play Sonny Corleone? Oh, you haven't got one. Okay, cool. You can pay me what I need then. They had struck a deal as well with Marlon Brando to appear in that scene as well, but he did the Marlon Brando thing and just didn't show up.
He's just an off-screen presence in that, which weirdly adds to his allure. It adds to the allure of his character, the fact that we don't see him at the end of that. It adds to like the absence of the character, you know, the inevitable death of the character that we know is coming. I think that scene, the abortion scene, is one of the best acted scenes I've watched in any film. It's remarkable. And I think Al Pacino's level of restraint and internal rage is really quite amazing. Because Al Pacino has obviously become famous. Well, he became famous from the 80s onwards, probably from Scarface onwards, a very, very outsized performances.
Overacting.
But yeah, yeah. And the level of internalized anger and desolation, emotional, moral desolation in his portrayal of Michael in The Godfather Part 2 particularly is really quite chilling and really captivating. A man who is utterly, utterly ostracized by the power that he wields, and who is completely fallen out of step with the initial destiny that was seized by his father as a young man, Vito, who arrives in New York. He's in a tenement building with his wife. Young Vito has nothing. He literally has nothing but four walls and a young child to provide for. And Vito wants to make the best of this new experience. I mean, he has to break a few eggs, figuratively speaking, in order to do it. There's a hit that he carries out on a character called Don Finucci, which is a very memorable sequence in which Vito uses an improvised silencer, which is basically a towel that then effectively catches fire. You know, this is Vito in the throes of becoming an experienced criminal. Lovely little details like that are brilliantly picked up by the masterful direction and the writing that it humanizes these characters. The great contradictory thing about all of the Godfather movies, and I'm including the much maligned third one in that, is that what you've basically done is you're thrown into the snake pit with a group of people who are, you know, incredibly violent, organized criminals, but who operate via very relatable principles. They are loyal to each other. They are a family. They love each other. Well, nominally, obviously, with Michael in the second film, that becomes, well, you know, an increasingly tricky prospect.
Especially with Fredo. That doesn't end well.
Yeah, John Cazale, who is brilliant, who's just fantastic in this.
John Cazale is literally great in every performance that he ever had.
Yeah.
Am I right in thinking that he only made five films, all of which were Oscar nominated for Best Picture?
Yeah, the one of the other ones being The Deer Hunter, in which he's fantastic in that as well.
He was The Godfather Conversation, Godfather 2, Dog Day Afternoon, Deer Hunter, and archive footage in Godfather 3.
I mean, it's amazing that The Godfather Part Two approaches the level of Shakespearean tragedy. I mean, when Michael realizes that it is his feckless, weak-willed brother who organized the hit on him at the beginning, and there's that brilliant moment where he grabs him in the middle of the dance floor, isn't it, and then kisses him and says, mm-hmm. I know it was you, Fredo, and you think, oh God, you can practically hear the funereal death knell like tolling in the background, and it's a question of not if but when the Grim Reaper is going to come for Fredo at that point. And it just confirms how utterly destabilized Michael has become from any element of reality at all. And then there's that fabulous moment as well where Fredo rails against his position in the family. He's like saying, I'm the older brother and I was passed over, but deep down he knows it's because he's weak. Michael doesn't have to say anything because Michael knows full well that Fredo is a loudmouth, but he's weak. He's not got the metal in order to make it as the Godfather. And all of these undercurrents are, you know, these very, very, you know, these very plausible undercurrents. These are things that are felt by non-criminal people the world over, day in, day out. And this is the brilliance of this series, is the way that it invests us in people that we would be terrified of, you know, that who are terrifying. And it's a fascinating contradictory mixture, I think.
Well, it's the classic look of a film. You don't need to like the characters in order to like the film. Like the way that Coppola makes you feel for these characters is absolutely astounding when you consider they're ultimately all abhorrent people. It was just, it's an absolutely brilliant film. I don't necessarily regret waiting so long to watch it because it kind of was what I thought it would be. It's in the world, it's out there. Like, you watch The Simpsons, you play Grand Theft Auto, it's there, it's influences in all sorts of different things. I love the way that it intercut and sort of how sparse it was with the sequel and the prequel elements. And, you know, I understand that they did a load of test screenings and there was initially too much cutting back and forth that was confusing, so they scaled that back. But specifically at the last scene, so we've talked about where Fredo gets killed, you then get the flashback to the dinner sequence, which is where Sonny is and where Vito was going to appear. And then we return to Michael sort of looking out over the lake, contemplating. And I think that just the structure of those three scenes, it speaks absolute volumes, and it absolutely wraps the film up in, it tells everything that you need to say of the films in the last three scenes. And that's not to reduce the impact of the previous sort of 2 hours, but it does really manage to get to the essence of it. And I think that these, without a doubt, are one film. Like, if it was now, these would just be broken up and put as a mini series, right? It would, or, you know, Martin Scorsese would put it all on Netflix and people could watch it on their watch. But these two films are absolutely astounding, and I'm very, very happy to wait another 15 years to watch Godfather Part 3.
It's a testament to the risks that were taken in the early 1970s, you know, during the new Hollywood period, where you got Scorsese, Spielberg, Coppola, Brian De Palma all emerging. It's a testament to the risks that were taken during this incredibly fertile period that you could release a four-hour gangster movie sequel, knowing that an audience would lap it up based on the, you know, the absolute roaring success of the first installment that had come out 2 years before. I mean, this was just an incredibly dynamic period for very, very grown-up filmmaking, you know, filmmaking that was kind of deliberately languorous and relatively low on incident, but absolutely high on character detail. It's character detail. Even when characters aren't doing very much, if you get the direction and the writing right and you cast the right actors, you can almost see the fireworks going off. You fuse that with the cinematography by Gordon Willis, who just turns the use of shadow into an art form, you know, in and of itself. I mean, it's got a lustrous, like, velvety look to it.
It was luscious. It was beautiful. It was like the color palette of it, the way that it is shot, and the way that what we see is absolutely phenomenal. And yeah, like, shout out to the cinematography on the film.
Yeah, and you know, when you're in the rooms with Tom Hague, you know, the consigliere, and you know, you do feel like you've actually pierced to the heart of the lion's den. You know, you feel like you can practically smell the cigarettes, like, when you're in the room with them. It's amazing, and the cast is incredible. You've got Lee Strasberg of the famous Lee Strasberg Institute plays Hyman Roth. He's Lee Strasberg, you know, helped define acting throughout the 20th century. He's in a supporting role in this movie. That's how brilliant the movie is. It casts Lee Strasberg in a relatively sort of incidental supporting performance. I mean, he's important within the role of the story, but he's not actually in the film very much. I mean, that's just how significant.
Well, it was also the role was rewritten for him. He was supposed to be sort of a more upright and athletic person, but because of the health issues he was going through, they sort of rewrote the role to accommodate.
It's just, I mean, there's just so much. There's so much going on. Nina Rota's score has got that same sense of Sicilian yearning and folk tradition that was present in the first film. Although I will say it was a mistake to give this score the best original score Oscar. That was a mistake. This movie deserved every other Oscar that it got. It did not deserve that one.
What should have then?
Claxon, Jerry Goldsmith should have won it for Chinatown.
I mean, I'm not going to argue with you on that.
We don't have the time.
No, you mentioned earlier on that the early 70s and the new Hollywood era was such a fertile time for exciting young new filmmakers. And since we last recorded the podcast, we lost the great Peter Bogdanovich. And I just wanted to take a few moments to pay tribute to him, because some of the films that he made were absolutely phenomenal. Like you said, especially around this sort of time. I mean, he did The Last Picture Show, he did What's Up Doc, he did Paper Moon, he did Nickelodeon, Saint Jack. Sort of moving into the 80s, he was nominated for the Palme d'Or for Mask as well. He was an absolutely trailblazing filmmaker, and you know, we lost him on the 6th of January. So just to highlight some of the films that he made, especially for me, Paper Moon, I absolutely adore that film. So and you know, The Last Picture Show basically discovered Jeff Bridges, right?
Yeah, adapted from the Larry McMurtry novel. The Last Picture Show is extraordinary. Mm. It's one of the best films ever made. It's got such a texture to it, not just in terms of the way it looks, but in terms of the way it feels, in terms of the emotional resonance of it. The melancholia is practically overwhelming in that film. And yeah, Jeff Bridges, Sybil Shepherd, Timothy Bottoms, just amazing, amazing performances.
Yeah, absolutely. And also he was involved with, believe it or not, Peter Bogdanovich was also involved with the television film To Sir With Love 2. So that being a sequel to the Sidney Poitier film To Sir With Love, who we've also lost relatively recently. He was an absolute trailblazer of a filmmaker. He kind of was mainstream black cinema in the 1960s. And when you think of the time in which we're speaking, he was an absolute tour de force. He was an amazing actor, and To Sir With Love, the first Sir With Love, is just phenomenal.
Can I just say, on the subject of Sidney Poitier, I know this is not a movie that a lot of people would cite in this instance. Sidney Poitier was in the 1992 film Sneakers with Robert Redford, which is one of my favourite films of all time. It's one of the best hacking movies ever made. It's so entertaining, and Sidney Poitier is brilliant. That has got one of the best casts of any film ever. I would encourage anyone who hasn't seen Sneakers and who is maybe looking for a Sidney Poitier retrospective, please go and check that out because it's fantastic.
And yeah, you can, I think that's available now on DVD and Blu-ray through Film Stories.
It is. Yeah, they arranged the Blu-ray. They helped arrange the Blu-ray release. Yeah, so okay. So thank you, Simon Brew, for that. I thank you very much for that.
Well, no. I will be honest, I'm a little bit taken aback that you could have had, you know, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner or In the Heat of the Night and you decided to go with Sneakers. But hey, that's your prerogative. And like I say, just two absolute towers of filmmaking that we lost both on January the 6th. So it's unfortunate, and but at least we've got the work, and thank you for the great work that they managed to do throughout the courses of their career. So next week on Frame to Frame, we are going to be looking at horror film remakes that supersede their originals. So horror films that have specifically been remade and do a better job of it. So we won't be talking about House of Wax starring Paris Hilton here. We're going to be talking about some great films. We're easing our way into 2022 with just some great films because, this week we were going to have great films. Like, we were going to have a good experience. Next week, I think we're also on pretty safe territory in that I don't think we're going to disagree too much about either of them. But next week, we will be looking at horror film remakes that supersede their originals. We always say we're a proud part of the We Made This podcast network. You can find out all sorts about the network. You can find the Twitter, the Instagram, the Facebook, the website, the Patreon. They're all available as part of the show notes here. There is, if you're interested in the Hollywood New Wave, there is a podcast in which I am scheduled to appear, which I've already recorded the episode for, called The New Wave as part of the network. And with that, they're going to be looking at different years through the Hollywood New Wave and picking different films. So the film that I looked at with Tony Black is In Cold Blood. So that is a really, really interesting and great podcast series if you're interested in that time period and films from that time. You can also find us on social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, Facebook. You can email us. All the information on how to find us is within the show notes. So please do feel free to do so there. So next week, we're going to be looking at horror film remakes that supersede their originals. Until then, I'm Andy Williams.
And I'm Sean Wilson.
And please continue on listening to hear some of the other great shows on the We Made This podcast network. Bye-bye.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
The Giddy Carousel of Pop.
I became really obsessed with music. It's sort of 1982. Fell in love with Simon Le Bon. There was a rumour in Australia, and I don't know if it existed anywhere else, and I've never been able to find verification of it on the internet, that he was the son of Brian Ferry. That was the rumour in Australia. Yes, seriously, and everyone believed it. Everyone believed it. I remember the first time I saw Planet Earth and my sister saying, oh, well, he's Brian Ferry's son, and I was like, oh, okay, that's good.
TARDIS crew.
It's got a real strong magic there, you know, the supernatural mystery, the supernatural Christmas ghost story kind of really comes together, and I think that's what works for me.
And it's also probably the first classic of McGann as the Doctor, because before this you had the TV movie, which isn't fondly liked, if we're being honest, and then all the stories with him in Big Finish that preceded this, none are marked down as you must listen to this, but arguably The Chimes of Midnight is the first story where you see McGann and go, yes, he is 100% the Doctor.
Pick a disc.
And then the Martians.
Which you're doing.
Yeah. And then the Martians construct a machine, which is like a spider-like vehicle to try and capture and collect humans and to harvest them.
Yeah, when they're seen injecting the blood of the humans into their veins.
Yes.
Which is pretty badass.
How old were you when you were listening to this?
I think I was probably 3 or 4 when I was first listening to
this. This explains a lot. Because it's quite good, because it's like kind of gruesome body horror, but without the visuals when you think about it, isn't it? So it's
yeah, so you're using your imagination, so it's even better.
So
check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.